Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who plays better when we're facing elimination. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and it is Wild Card Wednesday.
Yeah, that is an interesting concept. What is the concept of an elimination pod waking up and trying to stave off the end of this podcast? Don't worry. This podcast is way beyond double elimination. It'll take a lot more to get rid of us. And on this fine Wednesday morning, we'll be recapping all of the game ones in the wild card series. You will hear from us again, likely at the conclusion of the wild card round, regardless of whether or not they are all sweeps or all go three games. So that'll be the next time you hear from us. But because our regular Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule works well for this week, we are going to roll with it. Jake is in Philadelphia. He is tired. He watched the Phillies and Marlins. I will say, though, you could have been more tired. Shouts out to the pitch clock, which we will talk about. We will recap all four. We're very straightforward. And then at the end, if we have time, I will give you 90 seconds on what Jerry DePoto said yesterday. I don't want to do it, but everyone's talking about it, so we will do that.
Before we begin, make sure you subscribe to the show. It helps it grow. Send us emails. BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com. That is BARBcast. Okay. Yes. Before we get into specific games, I want to just touch on the nature of a three-game set. It is insane. It is hilarious. Because yesterday, we had eight baseball teams roaring to go, amped to get this long journey started, right? Ready for a month, hopefully, of postseason baseball. And then a couple hours later, in some cases 2 hours and 5 minutes or whatever later, because of the pitch clock, the vibe had shifted. Seeing Tampa, particularly, go from we won 99 games, we're starting at home, to, oh, if we lose tomorrow, we're done, is remarkable whiplash.
Yeah, and as we pointed out on Monday, it's better than one game, but because you have this series ahead, you have these grander plans because you know you can't be eliminated on the first day. And as you mentioned, no matter whether you won 99 games or 84, every team is putting out the hype video, right? Every team is putting out the, like, here we go, right? And they have a full 2 days to put out those tweets to get the fan base amped, right? And then, as you mentioned, half of the fans are going to sleep last night being like, holy shit, our season could end tomorrow. So, and the other ones are just like, oh man, we get to build all this momentum and we're about to have the most fun month of our lives.
So let's begin down at America's ballpark, Tropicana Field, the home of the Dome, the Rangers hopping on that transnational. Is that the word I want? It was a long ass freaking flight from Seattle.
A journey.
From Seattle. It was a haul from Seattle to Tampa Bay to take on the Rays in game one. We had Jordan Montgomery going for Texas. We had Tyler Glasnow going for Tampa. And the first five innings went pretty much as you would expect. Jordan Montgomery was outstanding. Mm. He was fabulous. He was superb. He was everything that Texas ever could have dreamed he would be when they traded for him at the deadline. And Glasnow was typical Tyler Glasnow, striking out a lot of guys, you know, brief bits where he just had zero idea where the baseball was going, but dominant enough through the early going, avoiding, like, the reason that Tyler Glasnow is worth it in the postseason, right, is if he gets into trouble and walks the bases loaded, he can just strike people out whenever he wants, more or less, right? And that allows him to get out of jams, whereas a more contact-heavy pitcher, you're going to allow some runs and some sac flies. I know he kind of did that as well. However, totally fine start for the Tampa Rays. And then everything changes, Jordan Schusterman. Everything changes with runners. What was that, on first and second and no outs? I believe it was in the sixth inning?
Yep, top of the sixth. Evan Carter and Marcus Semien draw some walks to lead off the inning. That is when Tyler Glasnow finally gets replaced after his fifth walk of the game. But The Rays defense had already been demonstrating some cracks earlier on, some very uncharacteristic moments from the Rays defenders. However, the defensive miscue we saw in the sixth, I would characterize as characteristic of Jose Siri, who was just added to the postseason roster yesterday, or made the postseason roster, I should say, after he had been out with an injury for at least some time. And he charges in on a Corey Seager regular single with zero outs and first and second. And not only does he kind of overrun it and botch the stopping of the baseball, he proceeds to pick up the baseball and chuck it with his 80 grade arm over the third baseman to allow two runs to score.
A free souvenir for a lucky fan right behind the dugout. Jose Siri, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, Jordan. He is baseball cocaine. And sometimes, actually often, that's a bad drug for you. Okay.
Yeah.
It is exhilarating to watch Jose Siri play baseball. It opens up a glimpse to another realm of what could be. However, it is playing with fire. Watching Jose Siri play baseball is like how cavemen felt with fire. They're like, this is sick, but it will murder us all.
And the best and worst part is that this has been true since he was in rookie ball.
Correct. Like,
and he, because he is so freakishly physically talented and has gotten his act together enough to be a somewhat reliable regular major league player with Tampa over the last couple of years, he has put himself in position to have the Rays trust him to be starting in center field in this first postseason game, right? So credit to him in that case. However, as you mentioned, that is still the wildness, the volatility is always lurking. And a play and a moment like that is just devastating because, Jake, not only is it an embarrassing miscue, which I believe was the Rays' third or fourth error of the game.
Third and fourth error of the
third
game.
Third and fourth, good point. that's a great point. The Rays offense, combined with Jordan Montgomery being awesome, made four runs seem like 40 runs.
Right.
And the 2-0 deficit that they took into the sixth inning, was like, okay, like, I don't know if you know about this, the Rangers bullpen kind of shaky. And at that point, you still think maybe Jordan Montgomery is going CG because his pitch count was so low. But you're like, okay, two runs. The Rays, I mean, the Rays can score two runs. They scored way more than two runs during the regular season, right?
Right.
But that 4-0 with the way they'd been swinging and with the way Montgomery was throwing was just so deflating.
The second Jose Siri threw the ball into the crowd, I'm surprised that 19,000 people didn't die because it sucked the air right out of that dome. That was basically it at that moment. The Rays failed to score a single run off of the Rangers' vaunted bullpen and take the fat L 4-0.
Yeah.
Let's quickly talk about the attendance thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was the smallest postseason crowd since 1919. On this show, we do not like to attendance shame. There are more way bigger reasons than the intensity of one's fandom that send people to the ballpark or keep them away. Location, the relationship between the organization and the city, trust, the entertainment level, all of these things are the affordability of the ballpark, right?
It's Tuesday afternoon.
Okay. I don't give a shit that it is Tuesday afternoon.
That is irrelevant to me. Okay, so, never mind. That's not a reason. I apologize.
Not a good reason. Tuesday afternoon, for not packing your place for a postseason game, is not an excuse. And here's why. The other cities did it. I know there was a little bit later. Like, Minnesota packed the place, right? We have seen teams pack the place. The Rays have had better home crowds than this at similar time slots. Like,
totally.
Teams get people out for the bigger spots, no matter when the games are. I would love for somebody from Tampa to explain to me like I'm an idiot, which maybe
or from St. Petersburg.
Or from St. Petersburg, why this was the case, why people didn't show up yesterday. Here's where I fall in it. The why matters, but in this case, it doesn't. Because it is such a bad look. It really is a bad look to announce a new ballpark. Right. And then like 2 weeks later, not get to 20,000 people at a postseason game, it is, to me, if a tree falls in a forest and there's no one there to see it, doesn't make a sound. Like, if you have 19,000 people out at the postseason game, at a wildcard game, what's the point of this all? Right? Like, aren't you playing for the people to have these moments? And it's also, just, it was very odd to me. Maybe I'm being insensitive about this, but I just, and I don't want to sound like a basic dodo who's like, you don't like your team enough. Come to the ball yard. I know there are other
reasons. You sort of sound like that, but I also don't disagree with you.
Yeah, like I just, it's just not good. Like I know there are reasons and maybe it's not fair to totally get on them for this. I just need to be educated on this as to why it happened. But just to see, and it was also like, maybe again, I'm warped. Like I was in Philly last night. It was like a freaking, you know, totalitarian political rally is incredible. And so like to see 46,000 people, 45,000 people in Milwaukee or whatever, and then like 39 in Minnesota, because that's their capacity, and then like 10 in Tampa was just jarring and confusing and abnormal, right? It is different. And I think that's why it is worth kind of sticking on it for a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and also, right, it's like they've been in, this is the fifth straight postseason. Obviously, some of those postseasons were not fan friendly and had far fewer than 19,000 people. But I agree with you. And of course, the other part with the new stadium is like they're building it in the same place. And so if you want to, you know, harp on that element of it too, that was definitely disappointing. So yeah, it's, I agree. I think the basic thing is it's less about, you know, shaming the Rays fans and more about just trying to understand why this is happening and that it is not a good thing for baseball, who had been flaunting attendance across the league all week because of the new rules and all those things. And I know it's different in every market, but like, I am with you on that. No, obviously I can't. I'm just trying to, like, the Tuesday afternoon thing, all this stuff, like all these things combine to make some level of difference. And when it is already a place that is clearly susceptible to having small crowds, every additional 500 people that aren't there is a significant number.
Last point, like you say, having the Tuesday afternoon game, you think ESPN and MLB are looking at this and be like, okay, well, we'll give them the night slot next time. Absolutely not. This is the, what you get. This is how it goes. Yeah. For today and tomorrow, how are you feeling about the Rays' chances to turn this thing around?
No, it was super, super disappointing. I was really confident with them. I think that the the Rays literally delivered the performance we expected from Texas in a lot of senses. Very sleepy, very, you know, deflated, all these things. But here's the thing, man. Like, Jordan Montgomery dominating is not, that did not stun me. It was more of just the how bad Tampa looked than on top of that offensively. And, you know, Glasnow was good, not great. And then, you know, ultimately, you know, Chapman and Leclerc, Chapman, listen, when you call out of the bullpen phone, you bring Chapman in, there is a chance he comes in and is throwing 101 and looks awesome. Like, that is a thing. And that is, that happened there. But the Rays' offensive Cuban attitude roulette to that point certainly contributed to how good he looked.
Yes. I think I picked the Rays in three. I think I picked Montgomery to dominate yesterday and the Rays to battle back and take it. Mm-hmm. So I still have faith in this team. I think this offense is better than it has been in previous seasons. Mm-hmm. And the quality of opposing pitching is about to go downhill.
I like the matchup just for Tampa because Eflin's been fantastic. You know, we could all make fun of, oh, wow, this is your biggest free agent in franchise history. Like, he's been fantastic. He also throws a lot of strikes. And Eovaldi's just not been very good. The stuff just hasn't been the same. So unless he's going to kind of unlock some next postseason level, we've obviously seen Eovaldi be amazing in the postseason. It's more of just like his physical stuff's just not been the same for months. So if that's the case, I think Tampa can take advantage. But man, credit to Texas for showing out there. But that's all Jordan Montgomery. He really shined. So very impressive stuff for them. So that's game one. Let's move on to our second game. Anything else with Texas and Tampa?
No, sir. Let's walk into the junk food aisle and open a bag of Twinkies as the Minnesota Twins take game one of the AL wildcard series 3-1 over the Toronto Blue Jays, snapping the streak. The streak is dead. Long live the streak. Their first postseason win in a game since 2004. They showed highlights on the broadcast. And you knew it was a long time ago because it looked like it was shot with a Motorola razor. The camera quality was subpar.
It's 2004. It's not the, you know, 1974, but yes, I agree. Our perception of these things is totally warped. Quick pop quiz, Jake. I retweeted this, but I don't know if you saw it. Who now has the longest postseason losing streak in Major League Baseball? Do you know?
I do know Jordan Schusterman.
Yes, and the number.
It is the Angels, Anaheim.
Oh, no. No, that's wrong. Postseason losing streak, not drought. That's a different thing. We're talking about two different things. Yes, the Angels and Tigers. That's the Mariners conversation, okay? That's the conversation we had last year when the Mariners broke the drought. Yes, Angels and Tigers, longest postseason droughts. No. Postseason consecutive games lost.
Toronto?
Yes, Toronto and Tampa and Cincinnati, weirdly, are tied at 6. So long way to go. Long way to go. And it's funny too, because, you know, two of those teams got there yesterday. So we'll see if they extend it to 7. But anyway, Minnesota, they have done it. L18, no longer. It is now a W1 in the postseason for the Twins of Minnesota. And before we get to the specific game, I think I wrote a little bit about this in my intro to the recap at Fox. It was very clear when Pablo Lopez arrived in the Johan Santana jersey, the jersey of not only his idol in Venezuela, but also the pitcher who last won a Twins postseason game, that this was not a matter of ducking this streak and this skid. This was a matter of embracing it and saying, hey, wouldn't this be fucking cool if we broke this streak?
We talk about Bruno.
We talk about it. And we will tell Bruno, no mas, no mas, my friend. Bruno. We are going to win this baseball game because we are the Minnesota Twins. We are good at baseball. And Pablo Lopez, this fantastic quote after the game. Without pressure, there is no expectation. Pressure is a privilege. Just understanding that mentality, using it in our favor. You always want to feel some pressure because that means there's an opportunity to do something amazing. I felt it. I acknowledged it. I accepted it. And then I put it on my shoulders and tried to go with it. Pablo Lopez, let me tell you.
What a smart
I wrote about
fucker,
Twins
dude.
Pitching. I know, right? I wrote about the Twins pitching going into the series, a piece I enjoyed. But my favorite part about it was just talking to Pablo Lopez for 10 minutes. Not, you know, a fraction of the quotes made it into the story. But what an incredibly insightful, smart, passionate person in this game of baseball. And I didn't even talk to him about anything involving the streak at all. Just talked to him about pitching and how much he loves being in Minnesota and how much he's loved embracing and getting better there. And all of it, why he loves the analytics and wants to know why he's doing any pitch and all these things, like just such a, and on top of just being like the nicest human ever. And Pablo Lopez did his thing, man, pitching into the sixth. I know the line isn't overwhelming, you know, only 3 strikeouts, 2 walks, but only allows 1 run. And the Twins defense, unlike the Rays defense, was balling out in this game. I want to get to the Correa play in a second, but shouts out to Michael A. Taylor, first of all, who made 2 tremendous catches, 1 coming in earlier in the game, and then later on a catch at the wall to rob Matt Chapman and maybe keep the lead preserved. But the Carlos Correa play, which I don't know if you saw this. This was earlier on in the game. I'm actually glad that you are going to watch this now for the first time. This is one of my favorite defensive plays I have ever seen. Okay, so this is the top of the 4th inning. You have the Blue Jays have runners on 1st and 2nd. I'm going to give Jake time to find this play. 1st and 2nd with 2 outs. Bo Bichette is on 2nd base. And Kevin Kiermaier chops 1 to 3rd towards Jorge Polanco, who, of course, has not played that much 3rd base this year because it's been a lot of Royce Lewis. He's been playing more recently, but whatever. So he charges in on the ball, and he misses the scoop. And when he misses the scoop, Bo Bichette, who is on 2nd base, realizes, oh, there's no one, like no one's getting that ball. Like I'm going home. He hesitates briefly at 3rd when he first gets there, but he's like, oh, I'm going. And I got to say, Bo Bichette, hell yeah. This is exactly the kind of base, like this is absolutely the right move. And when you see the behind home angle, you totally understand. You're Bo Bichette, like, oh, there's no one anywhere near this ball. But Carlos Correa, who began this play near 2nd base, and even when the ball gets past Polanco, is still basically standing flat-footed. It's not like as soon as the ball was hit, Correa was ranging over to back him up. No, Correa is standing flat-footed. But the second, the microsecond, the ball gets by Polanco, Correa with what might be his top sprint speed of the entire season, bolts over, picks up the baseball, and delivers a perfect off-balance throw to home plate to get Bo Bichette and end the inning. And it was just like, holy shit level instincts, holy shit level execution. A reminder of not just that Carlos Correa is a gifted defender, even in his physically compromised state, but also that this dude has played in 5 billion postseason games, and no weird situation is going to take this guy, is going to rattle him. 80th, this was his 80th postseason game for Carlos Correa.
Just watch this play. Incredible. Reminds me of the Manny Machado pump fake play, just from just where the pieces on the chessboard are, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the one thing to get over there. It's another to make the throw. It's remarkable stuff and par for the course for Carlos Correa. Speaking of poise, let's talk about Royce Lewis.
Let's do it. Royce. R-O-Y-C-E, although he didn't play enough to win Rookie of the Year. But I think it would have been interesting had he been healthier for much of the season. All due respect to Gunnar Henderson. But this man, this player. Now, it's funny because a lot of the tweets are, oh, man, it's like he was the number one overall pick. Okay?
Yes.
This talent has never been in question at a single moment.
Where'd he come from?
Is this guy? It's like, no. He was 1-1. Okay. And not just that, he was the Twins' best player for at least a couple months this year when he was playing, right? He was easily their best hitter. And then a couple weeks ago, he goes down with a hamstring strain, which is something he was dealing with earlier in the year. And it's like, oh God, here we go again. Like, I mean, undeniably and tragically so, here we are with another incredibly gifted Twins player who cannot, stay on the field. And it sucks, right? And Byron Buxton not on the postseason roster because he's still injured, whatever. But there was optimism. Okay, he's going to come back. But even as recently as Monday at the workout day, he was like, I don't want to be a hindrance to the team. Like, I know I'm not at 100%. Like, I'm going to give it my all. But it seems like he had a good workout. He goes in the lineup as the DH, batting third, and becomes the third player in baseball history to homer in his first two postseason at-bats, joining Gary Gaetti, 1987, who goes on to win the World Series with the Minnesota Twins.
And Evan Longoria,
yes,
who is a main character in the show we'll talk about later.
Yes, we will get to him with the Brewers and Diamondbacks. But not just that he hits two home runs, two very different home runs, right? He yanks one, pulls one down the left field line, absolute laser. He hits a towering drive to right field, which is what you need to do if you're going to hit a home run at Target Field with those weird dimensions and weird fence configurations. Royce Lewis delivers all the run support that the Twins pitching staff needed. The Jays offense was no bueno. I guess they had, they had guys, 2-for-9 runners in scoring position. Eventually Kiermaier gets a run late, but this was not, I guess Bichette and Guerrero had 3 of the 6 hits, and the Twins only had 5 hits. That's the other thing about this. This is why the Royce Lewis homers were so important, because honestly, Gausman wasn't that bad. Like, he threw 2 really terrible pitches to Lewis, and his command was other than that, pretty good. They used 5 relievers. Those guys kept the game, close. Like, the Blue Jays pitching generally did their job, and the Blue Jays offense, especially at the top, Springer 0-for-5. Biggio batting 5th. Going 0-for-4, right? Chapman had some good swings and was batting 8th. I imagine he will not be batting 8th today. Just a weird game. And I felt that the energy in general was way going to be in Minnesota's favor no matter what. We wondered, would the fans be nervous? No, it was the opposite. They were having a great time. All the stuff written about the Target Field atmosphere yesterday was amazing. It translated on TV. So fun. So cool to see that atmosphere. It was a really, really cool moment for them. And just a reminder of how good Minnesota is. I think, 5 hits is not great, but I was really impressed with them yesterday. And now they got Sonny Gray going to game 2 against Jose Berríos. Oh, what a moment for Jose Berríos, who had been one of those pitchers that had lost 2 postseason games in the past few years for the Twins. But now he's back trying to keep his season alive against them.
Did you see the quote from Sonny Gray's kid?
I did, yes. This is good. This is good. Sets up game 2, so go ahead.
I'm trying to find it.
I can basically paraphrase. This is from Dan Hayes. basically, you know, Sonny is given his
I got it here
day before it. Day before presser, and he has a few cute kids, I believe.
Yeah. Sonny Gray's 5-year-old son, Declan. Dad, is it the playoffs? Sonny. Yeah, it is. Declan, then you better not lose. That is a Magic Johnson-ass take if I've ever heard one.
Hey, but, I mean, is he wrong? I will say, less important than it was when he said that, now that the Twins have a 1-0 lead.
You could lose today.
Yeah, you could lose today. It's fine. It's like, we got Joe Ryan going game? Tomorrow.
Are you get up 1-0 with Joe Ryan, who looks totally rejuvenated going tomorrow against...
But I think Bassett. It'll be Bassett. Bassett?
Yeah. Yeah. Then you don't have to win today.
Don't worry about it.
Good. Don't worry about it, Dad. The Jays... So let me say this, Jordan. Have you ever said something and immediately regretted it?
Yeah. In your life? Yeah. Yeah.
Probably way less than me.
That seems like a safe bet, yeah. But it's happened. It happens to me. I'm human.
Yeah. I think... What the second I turned on the Jays Twins game, I was like, did I pick the Jays to win this? I did not have that feeling when I saw the Rangers up and I picked the Rays, or, you know, I did pick the Diamondbacks, but when the Brewers went up, I was like, but when I just saw the Blue Jays on television, I was like, the Twins are passing this energy on to them. Like, they are now holding the wet fart postseason torch.
I mean, yeah, and listen, there's all kinds of franchises that are holding some. And I was thinking about this too, right? You know, we end the Mariners drought, we end the Twins drought. What is it now that we are? What is the one in baseball that is most dominant? And we can, you know, that's probably a conversation for the offseason. But the point is I agree with you. Like, I just, and I think I said this in the preview, like, there was part of me that looks at the Jays roster and does think, like, okay, if they turn it on, fine. But it's the same thing as with the Padres. It's just like, I haven't seen it. And I know they played their best baseball in September, but even then it didn't feel like they were actually really heating up at any real moment. They would always deliver a real stinker. Now maybe they'll bounce back today. We're never going to bury teams in this situation. But I agree with you. Like, this was just a version of a Blue Jays game that I feel like I've already watched so many times this year. So it did not come as a particular surprise, but maybe they will prove us wrong in game two. As we mentioned, Jose Berríos against Sonny Gray. Jake, let's take a break at the midway point here. And when we return, we will talk about the chaos that was Arizona and Milwaukee. And then, of course, you will recap your experience at Citizens Bank Park, game one, Phillies and Marlins.
Hey everyone, producer Chris here with a quick housekeeping note about our merch. Look, in Australia, we love clothes and almost always wear them. If you're like us and also enjoy dabbling in clothes wearing, then why not consider some official Baseball Barbercast merchandise? Whether it's a jumper you're after, which you would call a sweatshirt, a cap, which we would call an old hair hugger, or a shirt, which we would call a belly wrap, we have it all for you. But that's not all. Do you also like to drink water or caffeinated beverages? Well, that's great, because we have mugs and bottles to help you quench your thirst too. To buy any of this merch, go to podswag.com/baseball. The link is in the description of the podcast. And don't leave yourself clothesless this post.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, getting wild, wild. Thanks. For the wild card round, we have talked about the American League first because we are proud Americans. And now we will discuss the National League because, like Jake Alou, we are proud Nationals. And we will begin at American Family Field, Miller Park in Milwaukee, where the Brewers hosted the Diamondbacks in the 3-6 matchup. Mm. It was Corbin Burnes, the 2021 Cy Young winner, against Brandon Pfaadt, the 2021 life liver, in what appeared to be an imbalanced pitching matchup. However, Corbin Burnes, in his current state, is not quite what you think of Corbin Burnes being, especially in that Cy Young season. He has very slowly declined in some ways since winning that award. He's still a very good pitcher. He's still probably one of the best 10 to 15 people on the planet paid to throw a baseball. He is not in the top five anymore. And that was a little noticeable in this matchup. But let's start at the beginning. Brandon Pfaadt, shaky out the jump.
Well, I think we should start even before that with a different Brandon related to the Corbin Burns conversation, which is that since we last spoke, we got the news that Brandon Woodruff would be out for likely the entire postseason with a shoulder injury. He had been dealing with shoulder injuries earlier in the year. And that's relevant because for those, you know, people who really want to have a hot take going into the season, it was like, but I smart people who I agree with. And I think I even said this to some degree, is like, is Corbin Burns the Brewers' third best starter because of how good Woodruff and Peralta had been? I don't know if that's true, but either way, that's how we thought about Brandon Woodruff and Freddie Peralta, the game two starter. And so that really immediately cast a strange spell combined with the Brewers roster in general, which had some very strange decisions, including bringing back Jesse Winker, who hasn't played since July, leaving off Rowdy Tellez, as bad as he's been, was kind of a stunning thing. Putting on Owen Miller, leaving off Garrett Mitchell, whatever. It was just like, this Brewers roster was weird. The lineup was a little strange. Okay. But still, it's like we're facing Brandon Pfaadt. He's a rookie. He's got a 6 ERA. We're at home. Like, we're feeling good. Corbin Burns is still a really good pitcher, right? And then on top of all that, what's the score 30 seconds into the game? 3-0 Brewers, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, that okay, plus, this is going to be a runaway train. And then it was like, this train does not have that much more gasoline in it.
That's it. The Brewers home night game from a tailgating perspective at that park, that must have been quite a scene outside. But you're right. So they go up early and it's like, okay, let's see how the Snakes respond. Let's see what they do. And who but Corbin Carroll.
Mm.
With a runner on base, Corbin Carroll launches one to a part of the ballpark that you don't often see baseballs go to in Miller Park, kind of the upper deck overhang in deep right center field. When I wrote my extensive feature on Corbin Carroll's high school career earlier this year around the All-Star break, one of the things that everyone who saw him in high school said was that the power was different and special and far beyond what you would expect. That Corbin Carroll would make contact with a baseball and that the baseball, you would have kind of an understanding in your head of how far a ball should go when it comes off a bat. And for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, the strength of his wrists or his bat speed or the way he creates backspin, the ball just goes when Corbin Carroll hits it. And as he was coming up through the minor leagues, and the big question was, will he hit for enough power? A lot of these people who saw him in high school, who are understandably biased somewhat, were like, he will hit for power. Like, this guy is going to hit home runs. He just will. And it wasn't just that he homered in that spot yesterday. It was how freaking far that thing went, man. It was crazy.
Oh, yeah. 444 feet, second farthest home run of his young career. And it looked like it went even farther than that. And it was the first time I've seen him pimp a home run as a major leaguer, as he should, right?
He almost like wanted to pimp it and then remembered that he was Corbin Carroll and that he is the generational descendant of Jeter Trout boringness.
But it was also kind of both. Like, it was also, he hits it and like the way that he swings and like the dismount kind of puts him already in a position to start running. But he did take a moment to kind of stand up straight and start walking. And then to your point, then he's like, oh shit, no, I'm still Corbin Carroll.
Exactly. Right. That's a great point because he's like falling out of the box towards first. Mm-hmm. And so for most players, they have to start running. For Corbin Carroll, he has to stop running to admire a home run. And I guess that in that way, he was taking a look at it.
He did.
So that made the score what? It was 3-2.
It was 3-2. 3-2. And then was it the first pitch from Ketel Marte, pitch, I believe? So Ketel Marte comes up and then it's just bam. I ain't waiting around. I'm taking this 95 mile an hour cutter down the middle and I'm going to hit it to a very similar spot. And suddenly it is 3-3. Now it's 3-3. We go to the bottom of the third, and it's like, all right, we're just gonna keep Brandon Pfaadt in there. Like, you know, we tied the game up. Like, we got to get some length before we turn this over to an Arizona bullpen featuring people nobody's ever heard of. And so he strikes out Canna. You know, Frelick gets on. Adames doubles. Donaldson flies out. And now here comes Bryce Terang, a lefty who's been really bad, but we still want the matchup. So we go to Joe Mantiply, and this begins a parade of D-backs relievers that truly was one of the more impressive performance of randos I've seen in the postseason in quite some time. And we will give credit to each and every one of them. But Joe Mantiply comes in, ends the inning. And then from there, it was D-backs were feeling good.
Be fruitful and Mantiply. I want to talk about No Schmo Joe for a quick second. Because in 2022, Joe freaking Mantiply was the only Arizona Diamondbacks All-Star. The only Arizona Diamondbacks All-Star. Not to say that this is the 1927 Yankees or the Showtime Lakers, but now they are a real baseball team. The type of baseball team that does not just send Joe Mantiply to the All-Star game. And so I am happy that he got to be the first link in the chain.
I agree, but that the other funny part is it's like Joe Mantiply has not pitched like an All-Star this season.
No.
He had been very good in 21 and 22. This year, he was not one of their more reliable relievers, but they went with the matchup. They knew they would have many more matchups to come. It's not like they're like, all right, Joe, you're going to finish this one out in the fourth inning. But in the top of the fourth, that's when things really swing because Gabriel Moreno, who we are both quickly becoming quite fond of as the franchise catcher of the Arizona Diamondbacks, says to Corbin Carroll and Ketel Marte, hold my beer that I've only been able to legally drink for a couple of years. Watch this. And goes kaboom on a Corbin Burnes slider to left field in one of the more impressive displays of power from a catcher. Gabriel Moreno has been a solid hitter this year, but the power you've really only seen in moments. He only hit 7 home runs during the regular season. He hit .284, which is very impressive for a 23-year-old catcher. But it's in there. The thump is in there. It's going to be about actualizing it. And for him to deliver that swing there was such a big, even with a one-run lead, now we're going back and forth. And now the Brewers' bullpen is having to kind of hang on for dear life, which they do. And Milwaukee, you know, gets a run back later against Ryan Nelson. Now it's, you know, it's 4-3 here. But what happens is Devin Williams comes in with the Brewers already losing. And this is a moment in any baseball game, but certainly in a postseason baseball game, that is one where it's like, yes, you want to keep the game close and bring in your closer. But when it backfires, it is one of the worst feelings you can possibly have as a fan in the postseason because it has the double effect of, oh God, we made this game worse with our best reliever. And oh God, how does this make us feel about Devin Williams tomorrow if he has to actually close out a game? Now, obviously, they're still going to go to him if they are leading today. But like, it's just a sequence. He throws 31 pitches that is just so devastating for a team, especially in the postseason.
Allows 2 runs. Diamondbacks take a 6-3 lead. Paul Sewald comes in the 9th and closes it out. And the Snakes are hot. Jordan, before we move on from this one,
yeah,
I would like for you to shout out and honor the heroes of the Arizona Diamondbacks bullpen, the men who out-brewersed the Brewers.
Yes.
No one out-pizzas the hut, okay, but you can out-beer the beerman.
Yes.
And that is exactly what happened
at
RIP Miller Park. So, Jordan, say their names proud. Say their names loud. Use your chest.
Joe Mantiply, as you said, 2022 All-Star. Miguel Castro, you got to be feeling good about that one. The skinniest of all skin. This dude is the lankiest of lanky. He gets 2 outs. Here comes Ryan Nelson, who was not very... He gets 1 out, allows 3 hits. But guess what? He still gets a hold because baseball is funny. They don't...
Hold this.
Ryan Thompson, you mentioned kind of out-brewersing the Brewers. A former Rays reliever who we've seen be an extremely goofy, unusual arm slot situation. He gets 5 outs. Very impressive, Ryan Thompson. And then Kevin M.F.N. Ginkle, who has been awesome for the D-backs, not just this year, but for the last couple. At one point this year, Kevin Ginkle was 9-0 as a reliever, which is hilarious. He really had very few bad outings. And for him to give them 2, because once they start coming out of the bullpen here, it's just a math problem of like, how are they getting all these outs? The term roadmap to 27 outs is one of my favorites. I don't know which manager popularized it at some point in the last 10 years or so that I remember, but it just always sticks with me. How are we getting 27 outs? And when Fott leaves in the fourth, that's just what you're thinking. How are you getting 27 outs? And so that moment when Ginkle comes back out for the eighth, it's like, oh, yes, sure. Let's see two innings from Kevin Ginkle. I love it.
It reminds me, Jordan, of one of my cockamamie idiotic logistical plans, mm-hmm. of which I am famous, where like it'll be like, well, you know, like my fiance has to take the car, but I would like to have my bike there. The train is delayed. If I walk 3 miles to the bus stop with my scooter on the bike, can I, you know,
like this will definitely work. Like this will get us to where we need to go, right? It's yes. Like, are you sure about that?
And Jordan listening to me blabber about that is like, okay, Jordan watching the Diamondbacks. Right. He's like, all right, like I'll see you there.
Like, right,
I'll
the equivalent, meet you. Right, being like, oh, if you could
Jordan's
get,
like, I'll drive.
Yeah, right. It's like, or if you could get like the equivalent of Torrey Lovello truth serum before the game. Hey, Torrey, like, what's your plan to get through this game? Yeah, so we're gonna go Fott for eight outs, and then just gonna go Mantiply, Castro, Nelson, Thompson, Ginkle for six outs. He'll strike out the side in the eighth, and then Seawald will kind of lock things down. But in the difference, you just say, hey, oh, Jordan, you'll just say, oh, you'll drive. Torrey Lovello didn't have a car, so he didn't really have a choice. This is what he had to do. But what he did have is much more than a car. He has a tank going on game two. Zach Gallen coming in game two against Freddy Peralta, who we thought would be game three, but now he's pressed into action. The last thing I will say about this game, Jake, on top of, you know, fantastic performances across the board. Christian Walker, by the way, three hits, some huge swings from him. This game, Jake, with a combined 12 pitchers. No, more than that. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 14 pitchers appeared in this game, Jake.
Yeah.
This game only lasted 3 hours and 36 minutes. A pitch clock achievement. And by the way, it felt like it was taking forever. And yet still, 3.5 hours. Totally normal length of a baseball game we used to be used to. And
it's amazing.
Man, salute that clock. Salute that clock, baby.
Let's take one more quick break because I need to have a sip of caffeine. And when we get back, we will talk about the Philadelphia Phillies. I saw them live.
Yeah, sure did. All right, we'll be right back. Phillies Marlins coming up.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Okay, let's talk about the Phillies. The main character of the playoff story. Let's not dance around the inevitable. Phillies returning to Citizens Bank Park for their first postseason game of the year. The location, the venue that defined last autumn. It was October's home field, even though they only had, like, I think 8 games there. Just felt like it. Felt like they were there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Marlins coming into town. The scrappy, scrappy little Marlins. Could they pull off the upset against the juggernaut Phillies? Zach Wheeler on the bump? No, they could not. The Phillies merge victorious 4-1 in a game that felt a lot more lopsided than 3 runs. I was there. I was in attendance. I watched the whole thing. I took a lot of notes. I wrote 2 articles about it. It infiltrated my dreams. Jordan, do you have any questions?
I mean, it kind of, this was, you could say the Minnesota one went about as expected, but this one was, I so little surprised me about last night's game that, not that it wasn't fun to watch or interesting, but it kind of hit every beat. Like, Lizardo was good enough to keep them in it, but they still managed to get to him in certain moments. And the Marlins did have moments of making it interesting late. The Phillies couldn't quite pull away in a meaningful way. But that, you know, like you said, like, and Wheeler was just tremendous. I mean, Wheeler, not that that was surprising either, especially when he's facing a lineup that is much improved, but still not necessarily the most fearsome postseason lineup you're going to see. So it really just checked every box. I was like, yep, that's how that went.
Zach Wheeler is a top 5 pitcher in the world. He was throwing a full mile an hour harder on his four-seamer last night than mm-hmm. his season average, mm-hmm. and you could tell. He's at his best. The part of the reason why Zach Wheeler is incredible, right, is because he has two different fastballs. He has the four-seamer that rides and rises at the top of the zone that guys swing under, the high-spin one. And then he has the sinker that he can kind of bore in on people's hands and get ground balls and weak contact early in counts. That makes him both a contact pitcher and a strikeout pitcher at the same time. And that dynamic in a postseason game is vital because mm-hmm. you can get a guy out on two pitches, which keeps your pitch count down, which lets you work deep into the game. And then if you do get into trouble and guys get on, you can reach into the bag and pull out that four-seamer and just tell people to sit the fuck down, right? And yep. that was Zach Wheeler last night. What a remarkable performance. One of the top five pitchers in the world.
Mm-hmm. And Marlins offense, Josh Bell's really the only one that showed up. Soler.
Okay, timeout. Showed up. Josh Bell.
Josh Bell's a beast, dude. Yes. And Josh yesterday. Bell came into the game with the most plate appearances against Zach Wheeler of any hitter facing a pitcher yesterday and had been crushing him. So he had a lot of experience against Wheeler, and you could tell. I think that when you... My general opinion on pitcher-batter matchups history and using that to instruct your lineup or whatever is overrated if we're talking about 8 at-bats. But if we're talking about 30 at-bats, which is what Josh Bell had against Zach Wheeler, I do care about that. And I think that showed last night. So he was absolutely locked in. But yeah, I mean, Soler and Jazz combining for 0 for 8 with 5 strikeouts, batting second and fourth is just not, it's not going to get it done when in a lot of spots. Now, Jazz had some tough strike calls against him. There was some, I'm not going to complain about umpiring, but there were definitely some spots there that Jazz got a little bit hosed. But in general, though, their offense was just not anywhere close to good enough. And the bottom of the lineup is just not very good. So that's kind of the situation they were in. And when you're facing Wheeler, like, it's going to be hard to score runs.
Jazz also tossed up one of the worst postseason plate appearances I've ever seen, mm-hmm. which was runner on first base, two outs. You're not going to string hits together against this guy, probably. And he goes bunt attempt, swing and miss strike.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, I don't know what – that was a very strange sequence that I didn't totally understand. So there was just some weird stuff. And Arise clearly compromised, still managed to get a hit. But he's not moving well, but we expect him to stay in the lineup. So just whatever. It was literally exactly what we talked about. The Phillies are a better team. It was like the Marlins kind of battled as much as they could, but that's and I thought Lizardo pitched pretty well.
The Marlins, he did pitch well. He got very fortunate in the first inning. His fastball command to the right-handers in the first was bad. Mm-hmm. He was catching too much plate. That's what the Schwarber single was. That's what the Turner double was. He had second and third with nobody out, and he grooves a heater to Alec Bohm, and Bohm just misses it and lines it out to right field where a perfectly positioned corner outfielder is. And so that bails him out. Harper comes up, 6 consecutive really good sliders. Then he gets Real Muto to pop up to end the inning. After that, his fastball command was a lot better. And he was the lefties were not going to touch him when he in those middle two. And like he looked amazing.
Yep.
Dominated Harper all night. But then he just kind of lost the fastball command again, started getting too much plate, left a couple sliders up. I think Bryson Stott was the one who, or not Stott, someone, he just left a change up in the middle of the plate and they just crushed it. And it wasn't quite enough. On the Phillies offensive side, The one surprise from this for me is that they never had the hammer blow. They did not hit a home run. And this is a team with the second most home runs since July 1st. Second most homers in baseball. And you kind of kept expecting it. Like the crowd there, the buzz of the crowd, felt like it was waiting for an Alec Bohm homer or a Bryson Stott homer or something where they was just going to explode. That never quite came. It didn't matter. They won the game anyway. But if Philadelphia wants to journey deep into this month, they will need the long ball to help carry them.
I agree. And again, credit to the Marlins pitching and the relievers that came in there.
Yeah.
I think an underrated group. But the thing that does stand out just about the box score, every Philly got a hit, right? They have 11 hits. Everyone in the lineup gets at least one. So that was impressive. Trey Turner, 2 more steals without being caught was also impressive. But yeah, you know, a moment of Kimbrel panic at the end, but generally, it was pretty smooth sailing.
That's just how we do things.
Yep.
Here in Philadelphia, you know, Craig Kimbrel coming in, going to give up some hits, baby, a lot of some base runners. Two other topics before we say goodbye to the Phillies for today.
Yep.
Rhys Hoskins' first pitch. I wrote about it at Fox Sports. It was incredibly touching, not just because, like, I guess I'll just build the context here. Hoskins, right, beloved figure, Philly cult hero, the longest tenured position player, the only hitter who was on just those horrible Phillies teams, the lifeless failed rebuild clubs of the late 2010s. He endures. He has an incredible October last year with clutch homers and is just a very interesting figure. Comes into this season, the last year of his deal as a Philly, likely to leave at the end of the year just because of the roster construction of this team right now, right? And his ACL goes kablooey. And it's just a huge bummer. Fights back. He's rehabbing. I think it's very unlikely he will play in the World Series. However, he needed to set that goal for himself. And for him to have this moment yesterday was very touching. Because Jordan, that might be it. That might be what we saw yesterday, the last time Rhys Hoskins wears the Phillies uniform at Citizens Bank Park. And so for him to go out there and get that moment wasn't just to pump up the crowd. It was a chance to say goodbye to him because he is headed down to Florida to continue his rehab. Now, he will not be around the team for a couple of weeks. If they continue to win games and win series, he'll return at some point down the line if he's healthy enough. But like, this was probably goodbye to Rhys Hoskins from Philadelphia. And I think the crowd realized that slowly over the course of him throwing out the first pitch, which was very cool, very touching. And he's like pointing to the Phillies logo on his chest, which is also like over his heart. And it was just, threw it to Schwarber. It was perfect. They did the whole thing very well. What I wrote about at Fox was he was actually initially resistant to do it. They asked him to do it about a week ago, and he said no. And he didn't want to, this is what he said, he didn't want to make it about himself. And so like the Phillies kept pushing him. We're like, come on, dude. And so he started asking manager Rob Thompson and some of the other teammates. And they were like, you don't want to make this about yourself. You idiot. Go do it if you want to do it. Like if you want to do it, it's not about Rhys Hoskins making it about himself. And Rhys was like, you know, I these guys have been working in here all year. I'm like, Rhys, you blew your leg out. Like you've been rehabbing. You've been working hard. Like it was just a hilarious thing. And so I'm happy that the Phillies convinced him to do it and that he was able to have this moment. Hopefully he comes back. I'm skeptical that he's going to make that happen. But it was very amazing to have him have that whole thing yesterday.
Yeah. He put in the work with that 17 and 18 team too. He didn't have to apologize for anything.
He earned it. Right. That's what Kyle Schwarber said to me. He was like, what do you think? Like what you think we're gonna, if Rhys Hoskins comes to us and they're like, and he's like, the Phillies want me to throw out the first pitch, should I do it? You think Kyle Schwarber's gonna be like, actually that would look really selfish, you know? Like that's not how that's gonna play. It was just very adorable. Yes. Second thing to talk about is the Nick Castellanos middle finger, not middle finger thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the best part about it is,
actually let's explain.
He gets to second base. It's a normal double celebration. Guys get to second base and they look back towards their dugout and they make a funny gesture or they do a funny dance or they do whatever, right? That's baseball. Nick Castellanos.
And the Phillies have one.
Right.
They have this like big balls thing that they do.
We've seen versions of this one before, yes.
Yeah.
But Nick Castellanos decided to go rogue. And essentially just do something that, my understanding is that after the game, he basically said he just did completely spontaneously, which is to put up his ring finger and point it towards the dugout. However, when you're wearing red batting gloves and, you know, they're not super zoomed in on you on television, it just looks like you're flicking off your teammates, which obviously makes zero sense whatsoever. But because the internet is the internet and because some people are quick to assume things, people are just like, oh, ha, 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 look, Nick Castellanos flipping off his dugout, right? It's like, okay, but like, this is a great example of, think about this for three more seconds, right? just three more seconds and then maybe you could arrive at the correct conclusion.
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters. It looked like he was flipping off his dugout. I know he's like, I want a ring on my finger. I want to win a World Series or whatever.
It was great.
But it does look like he's flipping off the dugout. Like,
It totally does. And we get the HD photo from MLB. They tweet out ESPN totally botches it, whatever. My question is, not to take this celebration too seriously, I feel like this is the one you break out like in the World Series up 3-1.
Jordan, you are giving Nick Cassianos, like Nick Cassianos did not wake up yesterday and was like, here's what I'm going to do.
Okay? No, I know, but that's the funniest part. That's 100%. Like he's the only person that would be willing to do this spontaneously in a way that like we've literally seen people do it in championship games up by 20 points, right? But that's why it's so great. Doing it in the first postseason game of however many that you need to win, 16 that you need to win 13, or 15 that you need 13, to win 13. Is so great. I love that. Love that energy. Nick Castellanos forever.
Today, Aaron Nola going to the hill against Braxton Garrett for the Marlins. Could be Nola's last home postseason start. Probably not. I think he will probably throw game three if they win in the next round, which will allow him to start at home again. He is a free agent at the end of the year. He is the longest tenured Philly, been here even longer than Reese. Mm-hmm. He has been shaky for long stretches of the season. His last two starts of the regular season were very good. Looked more like himself. And he doesn't need to be perfect. He just needs, you don't have to be faster than the bear, Jordan. You just have to be faster than Braxton Garrett. And Braxton Garrett got blasted in his final start of the regular season against the Mets. I think the Phillies will win it today. I think I will get to take a train tomorrow and sleep in my own bed, which I don't want to complain. It's literally the fucking second day of October. But anytime you can, you know, spend time with your loved ones during this wild month, you take those opportunities, Mr. Schuster.
It's true. It's true. So we will see. Maybe there is a plot twist in store, but that is generally where I see this series going as well.
You get 30 seconds on Jerry DePoto. I'm starting the clock, and it begins right now.
Mariners had an end-of-season press conference. It wasn't live-streamed because MLB doesn't want these press conferences to be a distraction during the postseason. Whoops! Jerry DePoto decided to say, we have a 10-year plan where we want to win 54% of our games over 10 years, and that's what's important. And we are doing the fan base a favor by considering sustainability and building towards a World Series instead of trying to go all out. Here's the thing. He, all-time example of saying the quiet part out loud. There are all kinds of GMs that think this way. None of them speak enough publicly and recklessly enough to say this publicly. Is this mindset a thing that happens in other front offices? Yes. Is this a thing that makes any sense to say at the end of your very disappointing season? No, not at all. It was disappointing from my perspective, but I also don't want to make too much of it because it's just, sorry, that's GM speak, and that's probably how they're thinking. If you're trying to figure out what 10 years he's talking about, you're wasting your time. That's not relevant. The point is, if you want to dunk on it, I get it. But unfortunately, this is how a lot of GMs think. So not the right message, though, towards the fan base. And that was definitely disappointing.
Bad feel, insulting, patronizing. As fans of Jerry DePoto, he has been on this show before. It was a bad look. Bad look. And not just bad look, but in my opinion, bad process. Jordan, that's enough on Jerry D in the month of October. And that is our show. We will be back whenever this series ends. It might be tomorrow night. It might be Friday morning. It might be both. We don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yes. Our general plan is, like, if we get a bunch of sweeps today, you'll hear from us Thursday morning. If not, we will adjust accordingly. You will definitely get a DS preview from us on Friday and maybe another podcast before then. But until then, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Chris Tyler, for producing. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for waking up early and recording this with me. We hope you all enjoyed. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Rate and review the show wherever you listen to your podcast. We appreciate the support. Plenty more coming all month long. Enjoy the game twos. We will talk to you soon. Goodbye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.